Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Greetings, fellow cesspool inhabitants. You're listening to what today's generation of writhing sweat glands refers to as a podcast. Normally, I'd proffer a snide remark about the idiocy of aligning yourselves with the commercial radio set. But in this case, you've actually done well. For you see, I'm the host of this particular program, and it is therefore worthy of your time. Who am I? Well, it should require no introduction, but just in case, I've overestimated your intelligence. My name is Lady P, and in case further clarification is required, there is no relation to Master P. Joining me today are two ladies that I deign to keep in my presence. First of all, we have someone whose name is not Lady P, and is therefore unimportant. Please direct your side eye, or side ear, as the case may be, towards Miss Anne-Marie Kelly. Welcome. Oh dear, she's become hysterical.
I had an opening line, yeah, and now I can't even say
not
it.
Even, do it anyway.
I detest cheap sentiment.
There we go. Also unimportant, venomous fishwife, Miss Kristen Sales.
Good morning, Lady P.
Thanks, Kristen.
I have nothing snarky to say. You're doing a good job.
Thanks. Today's show marks the first film in our Betty Davis series, all about Betty. We're taking a small break from the ridiculous sight and sound chronicling to talk about some truly great films. Without further ado, Kristen Sales is going to tell us why Joseph Mankiewicz's All About Eve is one of the greatest films of all time. Kristen, I'm becoming wary. It is now your turn to speak.
Okay. All About Eve. Well, I think All About Eve retains its importance as a classical Hollywood example for several reasons. It's self-perpetuating. It's a movie about movies. And it's a very important meta movie because it sort of gave Betty Davis a comeback and sort of launched the second half of her career. And she still stands as one of the most formidable actresses in the classical Hollywood period. Also won a bunch of Oscars. I feel like this is just kind of like one of the movies where when people want to pinpoint what classical Hollywood was about, this is where they go. It's very writerly and very actorly. And I feel like those are sort of qualities that have somewhat been lost or sort of subsumed below authorial, directorial intent. And so I guess I'm sort of beating around the bush. I think that this is a very good film, but I feel like its qualities are more exemplary for a certain time and a place and a mode of making films and a mode of a star system that doesn't exist anymore. So it's good, but I feel like I'm a little hesitant to say that it might be the greatest of all time.
Wow, okay. Well, first of all, can you just... brief synopsis.
Yeah, so All About Eve is sort of a classical tale of comeuppance, of sort of subterfuge and revenge and backstabbing, which is obviously why it is still so popular. So the title character is Eve Harrington, who starts out being a nobody, just a stage door Johnny to Margot Channing, who is Betty Davis's character, who is a famous stage actress. And then eventually Eve sort of creeps up into her entourage and sort of embeds herself into her life as a little kind of like a little termite or something. And then eventually becomes Margot's understudy, and you know where it goes from there. She becomes the next hottest thing, and there are all these... intrigues with Margot's relationship to the industry, to her own self-image in her personal life, and all of these things sort of come to bear. So it's, you know, it's the young sort of rising up and displacing the old, mm-hmm. which is definitely a story that Hollywood likes to mine over and over again, because it is, in truth, what happens to actresses.
Yeah. So, it's I guess maybe I should clarify for listeners. We were trying to assign parts for this Bette Davis marathon, and Kristen, I don't know, you didn't have a strong...
No, I did. Of the three, there wasn't one that I was more in favor of. So I thought, okay, I'll rewatch All About Eve and see if I liked it as much the second time, or the third time, I don't remember how many times I've seen it. But it sort of diminished in estimation to me, which I was surprised about. And I still think it's good. I feel like, especially in relation to the other two films in this miniseries, I feel like there are elements of it which are not as strong when compared to the other films. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was like, I think it's important in this series, especially to sort of like track chronologically what's happening in Bette Davis's career and in her performance style and how that changes with the people that she collaborates with. So I think as an example of her collaboration, and certainly it's a linchpin in her career, so it's important to talk about in that way. But I feel like there are a lot of elements, especially visual elements, that are stronger in the other two films. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I should say, I mean, listeners who have been with us since the beginning know that this is my favorite movie of all time, if not one of my favorites, if not my favorite.
So I'm looking forward to getting into it with you.
I mean, I will say, rewatching it now, I have my thoughts are, I have very different feelings about it, and they're more complicated. I remember seeing this on a big screen and just kind of being just bowled over by Bette Davis's performance. I mean, it's just something that, like, this is why I love classic film, and it was basically a perfect showcase for Bette Davis and all of Bette Davis's strengths. I think when I first saw it, the whole conversation she has with her friend Karen in the car about just kind of the limitations and expectations about being a woman and the sacrifices that entails, that was all just kind of a revelation. And I think this is kind of a movie that changes as you get older, you know, your perspective changes and the movie changes with it. And there it's so complex. There's so much going on. The screenplay, I think, is, I don't know. I think it's just so well constructed. I guess I've heard people say that it is not the most visually appealing film. There is kind of a workmanlike quality, but I don't think that, I think the shots are well composed. Like, I watch it and I think I could frame this picture. Like, I could frame this frame, you know?
Well, I think when Bette Davis is in frame, you could frame it, because mm-hmm. you're right that that's what Mankiewicz does, is it is a showcase for her, and she is the central figure, both, you know, figuratively and literally central in the frame most of the time. It's just, I think I agree with all of these points. I just feel like, but for me, I was sort of bowled over in the same way the first time I saw it, with just the totality of Bette Davis's performance is too weak a word. It's just like her domination of this material and everyone in it. But then the more I watch it, the more that sort of becomes a little unappealing to me, because in contrast, everything and everyone around her appears a little too weak.
Mm.
It feels quite lopsided.
Interesting. I guess that was what changed for me watching it this time, was that I really did appreciate everything that Anne Baxter was doing in the role. She has, obviously she doesn't get to chew as much scenery, but she is... she chews whatever is left. She basically gets the leftovers.
You're right.
It's not a subtle performance, but I think there are no subtle performances in this. And despite Bette Davis's dominance, I do think that there's still, what's left is still meaty enough for everybody. In this movie that is essentially a showcase for Bette Davis, George Sanders also makes his presence known.
Yeah.
Thelma Ritter, who's in it for maybe 10 minutes of screen time, like, that's a memorable character, right?
Yeah.
So it is a showcase mostly for Betty, but also I think everyone gets a turn, you know?
I think the other women and George Sanders get...
That is true. I do want to talk about the men.
Yeah, it's like you could watch this 10 times and forget there are any men in
it's
it.
It's so true.
I guess that's sort of what I mean in terms of the other characters sort of wilting under the theatrics of what Betty Davis is doing. And also Anne Baxter, who gets to be a sort of deliciously cold, especially towards the end of the film. That is very satisfying, but I guess it's more just like my hesitance towards just being, I mean, you called the visual style workmanlike. I just feel like it's you know, you're framing Betty Davis's face in medium shot and sometimes her body, and that works, but there's, you know, I just look at the way that it's developed visually and I see opportunities where there could be something else going on that would be as economical, and those choices just are not made.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm starting seeing like an alternate version of the film in my mind that would have been a little bit more just interesting.
Mm. All right. Fair enough.
Like moving the camera a little bit wouldn't kill anybody.
I mean, it does move. I actually, watching it this time, I was like trying to keep track of when the camera moves, and it does.
Yeah.
A little bit. You know, it's... He's not King Vidor, but, you know.
So I think what we're trying to parse out here is that the two other movies that we're going to be talking about are extremely visual movies. I mean, they've got a lot of Betty Davis going on, but they've got a lot going on camera-wise and lighting-wise as well, cinematography-wise. And so it's a little bit difficult to go from, you know, the gothic or the deep focus to the much more utilitarian mode of filmmaking that Joseph Mankiewicz is known for. That said, I think that Mankiewicz should be given credit for how solidly structured the script is. I think it's a great script.
Mm-hmm.
Unsurprisingly, actually, if you think about it, Joseph Mankiewicz's brother is Herman Mankiewicz, who did Citizen Kane, and there is a lot of similarity in how those two movies are structured.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I really love about All About Eve is, as we've been kind of talking about, it's this meta-text about film. It has hugely influenced the idea of Betty Davis as a star. But not only that, it's actually a movie about how the star mythology gets constructed, how rumor and experience and everything else really creates this idea of a person that isn't actually necessarily who the person is themselves. And we get that through the, you know, different points of view of three different people through Eve's career.
Yeah. No, that's a great point, actually. And I always talked about Citizen Kane as being just a completely subjective experience, like the whole told, every single part of that story is completely subjective, and each character, each portion of that film is filmed in a specific way. And while, again, there's no visual element that is distinctive in each portion of the story, there is I do think that every aspect of the story has a unique point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great analysis, actually. Like, it's less about Eve herself or Margot herself, as opposed to how the myth of Margot and the myth of Eve gets developed over time through the experience of other people.
Yeah. I think somebody somewhere out there needs to do a like super cut of all of the times Betty Davis has been in movies where like mirrors play a major focus in them. Because mirrors are a huge symbol used in this movie. Not in the same way that it tends to be where it's a actor in front of a mirror contemplating themselves, which happens in a lot of other Betty Davis movies. But in this one, mirrors specifically have to do with like the shallowness of image and replication of image. Because so often who you see in the mirror, the first time you're introduced to Margot Channing, she's slathering on cold cream and like yelling through her dressing room. And she sees Eve in the mirror. The next time you see a mirror is when Eve is trying on the gown. The next time you see a mirror is that famous last shot of the new girl trying on Eve's gown.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a connection in the movie between replication of image and shallowness of image and the inability to see past surfaces,
mm-hmm.
which is a lot of what the tension in the movie is who is Eve Harrington really? And who is Margot Channing really, and also, like, who are they presented as?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, like, the eternal quality of the story. The story to me feels just classical in the sense that it's always existed, you know, in sort of like a Greek tragedy way. And that final shot when Eve is in the mirror and it's perpetuating to infinity. There are an infinite amount of Eves, and this will happen over and over and over again. It's going to happen to her. It'll happen, you know, to the end of time. And that, to me, it seems like that sort of the largeness of the story that they're telling, the sort of inevitability of it, does come into play in a way that it sort of, it doesn't necessarily undercut the specificity of the story, but I think it brings another layer of this has happened before this story specifically, and it will happen after, and it doesn't really matter. The specifics of who these people are is maybe not necessary to appreciating the story because it's a classical story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think at the center of that then, or not technically at the center since the movie is not called All About Margot, it's called All About Eve, is Bette Davis's, it's a very big performance that she gives. And usually when I think of what my favorite Bette Davis performances are, they're the ones that have that kind of laser focus to them, movies like Jezebel, movies we're going to be talking about later in the series. But I think the messiness, the broadness of it actually contributes to it, because this is a character who's supposed to be kind of an actress first and a human being second, who believes that of herself. The problems that she consistently runs into are putting her idea of herself as an actress in front of her idea of herself as a human being. There's that whole kind of sexist, because it's the 1950s, bit on wanting to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But it does speak towards what you were talking about before, Lady P, with kind of those issues of not just career and humanness, but like celebrity. Mm-hmm. And I think I love that this movie that is all about what it means to be a celebrity and what it means to be an actress is the movie that is most associated with Bette Davis, the star. I don't think that's an accident. Mm-hmm. Richard Dyer talks about how stars are commodities and what they're selling is an image. And certainly that's true of studio system movies. You saw a Humphrey Bogart movie, you knew what you were going to get. You saw a John Wayne movie, you knew what you were going to get. By this point in Bette Davis's career, she had a very specific image, which was the, you know, woman who tried to take down Warner Brothers and failed. Thank you, Olivia de Havilland. And the person, you know, the woman who started feuds with other actresses, like this big, broad, brassy character who by this point was not making a lot of movies anymore because the time for big, broad, brassy women had kind of passed her. But I think the reason this movie gets attached to her now is because it's so easy to just look at Margot Channing and say, ah, yes, that is everything that Bette Davis is. Whether she really was or not Margot Channing, when we think of Bette Davis, when we retell stories from Bette Davis's life, they are the Margot Channing type stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you say it's sort of anti-feminist, that whole speech in the car. Like, I think it's kind of proto-choice feminism, kind of. It's like that eternal struggle. I mean, it may not be presented in a way that we would present it now, but that whole you can't have it all sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I think we're still dealing with that, and mm-hmm. I'd never seen it, at least in a classic Hollywood film, I'd never seen it presented in a way, in such a complex and thoughtful way.
Mm-hmm.
So
I don't think it's anti-feminist, it's just proto-first wave feminism, which is all about domesticity,
right?
Which is a little bit like not where we are in 2016. Hooray!
Yeah, thank God. so in that sense, like, it is kind of dated, but
you're right that at least they're talking about it,
yeah,
sort of honestly. And
yeah,
the whole narrative literally stops for that scene when mm-hmm. they're in the car, they run out of gas, and then let's have a talk about what it means to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
It is kind of unique in terms of screenplay structure and even hearing somebody talk about those things with a kind of forthrightness. And it is kind of the first time when those characters sort of get to be the maybe quote-unquote real versions of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that element of sincerity is, I think, notable within all of this, this story about artifice and ambition.
Yeah, and that brings me to the point. This, the tagline for the movie is all about the women and their men. If this movie has a weak point, it's that the men are terrible.
They're just, they're like cardboard mannequins. Yeah. Well, except for Addison DeWitt, but
well, yes.
I don't think he really counts.
No, no. But by men, I of course don't mean Addison DeWitt, because Addison DeWitt is amazing. But, it's my hero. But,
hi.
but yeah, Bill and Lloyd, like, not, Lloyd is a piece of shit. Bill is, he spends most of the movie mansplaining to Margot, like, who the hell do you think you are? She's Margot Channing. Get out of here. I don't know, but I guess it never bothered me on past viewings. Like, they seemed like they were pretty good match.
They got married afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
Mary
yeah.
Merrill and Betty News did get married afterwards.
That is true. But she, I don't know, the sexuality in this film is interesting. Mm-hmm. Margot reads to me as very, very heterosexual. Other characters,
to a fault.
Yeah, perhaps, yes. other characters, maybe not.
what a wonderful opening, that
yes.
is.
And
over to you.
So, honest to goodness, the first time I watched the director's commentary of it once, except it wasn't director's commentary; it was a scholar's commentary. And so I was like, and there is a queer reading of All About Eve. And I was like, I don't see it. And then I watched it on the big screen and I went, oh my God, Eve is so gay.
Super gay.
Super gay. And so is Addison in that kind of very specific, weird, like his entire thing about owning her now in that very self-hating queer kind of way that only the 1950s could do of like, well, we're both gay and that means we're both villains. So I deserve you. Mm-hmm. Like,
that's what that means.
Yeah.
Yep. I had that same reaction the first time I saw it. Actually, I think it was you who mentioned that there was a queer reading, and I didn't see it. And watching it this time, it was so obvious.
So what I kind of love about it, because when I was rewatching it again, I do not know how many times I've seen this movie, but it's been a lot, is I always picked it up as Margot is super, super straight. Eve is not. And Margot doesn't know it. But I was rewatching it this time, and that scene on the staircase where would you like to tuck me in?
Mm-hmm.
And Eve says yes, as if she's like already got the dress off. because Ann Baxter can do bedroom eyes like nobody does bedroom eyes. But
this is true.
I think the reading of it that I'm getting more along the lines of now is that Margot is somebody who needs constant gratification and constant attention, which is part of the reason why that entire very screwed up relationship even starts is because she just needs somebody to mirror her and tell her how great she is and hold her up and say, aren't you special? And so it almost reads as if like she knows the entire time that there is this, in 50s parlance, dangerous attraction happening to her. It's like the steps up to Fatal Attraction without the ending of Fatal Attraction, or actually the rest of the movie. So it's since it's a movie from the 1950s, and this is, you know, around the time of Teen Sympathy and Rebecca, this is not like a particularly nice queer reading. She's the villain, and part of what makes her a villain is how much she wants to devour Margot.
Mm-hmm.
To borrow something from another
valid.
Yeah, yeah. to borrow something from Suddenly Last Summer.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's important for that. And it's important because it's also important because this movie has gotten picked up in queer culture and kind of replicated when we're talking about replication. This movie has gotten replicated in queer culture so much.
Mm-hmm.
And not just gay male culture, which is, of course, obsessed with Bette Davis for very good reasons, but also in gay female culture, too. We've got like Showgirls, which is a not even like subtle remake of All About Eve, told entirely from Eve's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That's the sequel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
We're next.
Yeah, we should really talk about Showgirls. One season of The L Word, like randomly, suddenly
God.
Became.
I need to watch
All About
the L Word.
You really don't.
Okay, no.
You really, really don't. And even Pedro Almodovar's All About My Mother gives like major like nods to All About Eve, not only in the title.
Mm.
So I think it is one of those kind of complicated movies in queer culture where it's like, yay, representation of some kind. It's not the kind that we want, but just the fact that it exists makes it important.
Mm-hmm. But the fact that it exists also makes it problematic.
Yeah, it's the joy of queer Hollywood history is right. Like, yay, oh.
But I think it's problematic too from the standpoint, not necessarily a queer reading, but just a standpoint of what kind of stories about women does Hollywood tell? Because I feel like the totality of Bette Davis's performance and how this is such an integral part of her, of the mythology of her as a Hollywood movie star, and also the fact that it was so awarded and the fact that this movie remains so famous, sort of not, it seems like it should have been liberating to sort of say, to sort of write a piece about a woman who is aging and in Hollywood and what those struggles are. But it seems to have maybe done the opposite, which is to sort of provide a dominant narrative for a woman of that age, which is this kind of story. That is, you have to deal with these struggles. You have to, there must be limitations on somebody in an industry who is maybe aging out of that industry. You must have that sort of conversation about how you can't have it all, and you must be conflicted about that thing. So, and I think that that's a problem that we see even today, that it's like, you know, if an actress is sort of looking for a show-stopping part and they are maybe not 40 plus, because I feel like we're getting a little bit better in terms of pushing that number up a little bit. But it's just like that is the kind of narrative that you're going to seek out if you want a part like this. Mm-hmm. So it is sort of, I mean, it's self-perpetuating and self-defeating in a certain way. And I don't know if that is, I don't know if that's something that that could have been avoided just in terms of dominant culture, but I think it's, that really stuck out to me this time when I watched it, which is, I have seen this so many times.
Yeah, I think what's probably the most surprising part of it is how unsurprising it is. There is something, you know, disappointing but not surprising, considering it's a studio system Hollywood movie, that Margot's salvation, for lack of a better word, is the domestic sphere, like mm-hmm. to retire and mm-hmm. be a little housewife. Mm-hmm. Like that's her win, is giving everything up that mm-hmm. she's devoted her entire life to. Whereas the villains is, the villain being Eve, the villain's like downfall is continuing this career that she's just going to be overtaken by somebody else in a few years. And that's, you know, as in 2016, looking back on that, that sucks. Mm-hmm. That's a real, nobody at the time would have been like, well, that's really surprising, because it is one of those kind of institutional ideology type situations. But yeah, that's a good point. It's something that, it's a narrative that hasn't shifted a lot. Even if you look at movies like Ricky and the Flash from last year with mm-hmm. Meryl Streep, it's well, you're too old to be a rocker, maybe you ought to settle down. Like, nobody says that to Keith Richards.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and very importantly, nobody says that to Meryl Streep or Bette Davis. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of that thing of, we're going to sort of confront these ideas in a narrative form, but the truth of her life actually sort of disproves the idea that a woman needs to be conflicted about having a career.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is a narrative that she tells over and over in her career. It's all, she's yeah. really into punishing her characters mm-hmm. and into putting them out to pasture. They often die in horrific ways, or they develop early onset dementia. what feels progressive about All About Eve is, like, it's not so much that Margot is old and worn out. It's like she's making a choice that she no longer wants to be part of this horrible cycle. Mm-hmm. Like, she's opting out. Whereas,
well, but she's forced out.
I mean,
don't you think?
Yeah,
because none of the problems, to me, part of the movie that strains credulity is that this hadn't happened before. That this is the first time that a young actress has come and threatened her? That mm-hmm. seems like, how is Margot Channing able to maintain her dominance for so long? And then there's like one obstacle, and the whole thing resets.
Well, that's true. Right. There's Marilyn Monroe too. It's just,
yeah. Marilyn, there's a special Monroe kind of predatory nature about Eve, which we should also probably talk about.
Predatory.
Yes.
Check.
Yep.
Predatory lesbian.
The predatory lesbian. But in this case, it kind of subverts the trope because she's the younger one, right? Typically, your predatory lesbian is the older school marm.
This is a social climbing lesbian.
Yeah. Revolutionary, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, just as compared to something like The Star, where she really is forced out. There's something about her choice here that feels empowering. And I did feel at the end like she could go back and maybe not in the same position, but she still had the choice to go back and perform if she wanted to.
We're never given that, though. The last third of the movie is so entirely all about Eve, that we're never given what Margot feels about it. She basically just disappears, considering she's the best actress Oscar nominee that year. She just disappears from the last third of the movie.
Yeah.
We have no sense of whether she wanted to be gone or not. She's just gone. So the nice thing about that is that you can read whatever you want into it.
Yeah.
The terrible thing about that is that you can read whatever you want into that. It's really difficult to parse out how that decision goes, because the decision is left completely out of her hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I'm choosing to be optimistic.
Well, if you should have learned your lesson watching this movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where is optimism?
Yeah.
I do want to go back to that thing that you said about Bette Davis always punishing her characters, though, because that's an interesting point that I kind of hadn't thought about before. But when we are talking about how star images get constructed, the big line about Bette Davis, which is a very good line, is that she's, you know, she portrayed all of these strong, very powerful, very badass women throughout her entire career. Even every time she resurrected her career, there was another one. But really, like, strong, as annoying as that term is in this case a stand-in for, like, complicated and complex women. But by the end of each of these movies, in order to conform to societal expectations, you can start a complicated woman, but you have to end up married or punished by the end of the movie. That's the only option. I mean, we talk about that with film noir all the time, and I think that's the reason why film noir did this as a divergent, but I think this is why film noir still registers now, is because you get these complex female characters so often, as opposed to like other genres that aren't as able to do it. But yeah, Bette Davis throughout her entire career plays women that either get married or get punished for not being married, and they're almost is no in between. There are very few movies where she's allowed to remain complicated and messy.
Yeah, which is strange, because like her she's working within the women's picture genre, and you'd think that there would be a little bit more wish fulfillment in these movies. They're always so bleak, like her options always are, they're always so limited.
Well, this is an issue of context again.
Right.
Like in the 40s and the 50s, wish fulfillment is getting married, is sacrificing everything for your loved one. Like that's the ideology of the time. We're still not at any wave of feminism yet, so like dominant ideology would say that's what it should be.
I mean, the wish fulfillment comes in the first and the second act. The wish fulfillment comes in the fact that, you know, Susie Housewife goes to the movies and sees Bette Davis on the screen. That's the wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what happens in the last 15 minutes, because that's the code, and everyone sort of buys into the social construct that everyone knows that's the case. You go to the movies, and if somebody has violated a social contract, they have to get punished.
Absolutely.
But, you know, for the first 70 minutes of the movie, you got a badass right there, and that's what people take home with them. I mean, and that's sort of what happened. That's, you know, part of the, like you said, it's the sort of the pleasure and the pain of enjoying anything that's made in this period, because you can't really go against whatever the dominant culture is, and yet as soon as the sort of the code fell out, these roles for women fell out, and movie stars became more masculine and less feminine, and there are fewer female stories. So yeah, double-edged sword.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, we can't end this conversation without talking just a little bit about George Sanders.
Yes.
If only just to say, George Sanders, isn't he great?
He's great.
He's the best.
Super great.
What a great guy.
What a mensch.
That venomous fishwife.
Oh, man.
Fishwife. Yeah, I mean, I love so much about this movie, and I don't know if we've really, like, there are certain problematic aspects to it, and it's not as, I guess it's not as feminist as I would like it to be. But it's made in 1950. But there's so, I get so much pleasure watching this movie. I get so much pleasure just listening to George Sanders in anything.
He has a voice that you might call mellifluous.
A little bit, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. and to hear Mankiewicz's dialogue coming out of George Sanders, it's like just such a pleasure.
There is a real, I wonder how much he thought about who he was giving all the best lines to.
Mm-hmm.
If that ever came up in terms of, like, Bette Davis being like, stop giving George Sanders all the lines! Giving him too many lines. It's fantastic. I mean, this Addison DeWitt is such an archetypal, sort of instantly iconic character, just in that casting. The way he carries himself, the sort of, like, queen bitchiness of it all is really, really delicious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, really, I mean, we've talked a lot about Margot, but I do think everyone really gets their turn to shine, including Marilyn Monroe, who, baby Marilyn.
I mean, she's good in this.
She's great. Mm-hmm. She's perfect.
It's a dream role, dream cast.
Yeah.
She just hits it out of the park.
Yeah. The only issue that I have in the entire movie when it comes to Marilyn Monroe is actually a costuming issue. I think Edith Head's costumes are brilliant through the entire movie, especially if you watch Eve slowly start dressing like Margot, so that at the party they're actually both wearing the same neckline cut.
Uh-huh.
But in that party scene, Bette Davis and Anne Baxter are both wearing black, or what reads as black, it was actually green, and Marilyn Monroe's in white, and then she gets positioned center. And so there's this huge fight happening between Margot and Eve, but instead you're looking at the woman in white in the middle who has nothing to do with the argument. And it is my only fetch in the entire scene, because she has nothing to do with that argument. She's just there to deliver a line about sad bunnies and book it.
Yeah,
but don't you think that's probably because they wanted people to be looking at Marilyn?
Oh yeah, it was a test role for her. They were absolutely
right. So that's the. I mean, okay.
Yeah.
No, I know why she's there.
Yeah,
I'm just gonna have a moment and be like, she's gonna be a star. Give this scene a chance to play anyway.
Yeah, everything about the scene, that scene where she's in it, is about getting people to look at her, which is not very hard. It's Marilyn Monroe, but I understand.
So in a way, Marilyn Monroe is actually the Eve of this movie,
right? She's the third Eve. She's the third face of Eve. I mean, it's obvious that she's being groomed, but it's like I like that scene too, because you get that insight into Addison DeWitt's sort of conniving grooming as well. Like, that's going on, like, as a side job for him, is like sort of like inviting these ingenues to this party and being like really creepy.
Go sleep with the producer now.
Yes, exactly.
All right, well, let's put it to a vote. Kristen, have we managed to drum up some enthusiasm, or are you kind of still
ambivalent? I think All About Eve is a very, very good film. I think it is still a good film when we talk about classical Hollywood cinema. I would put it on a list of best Hollywood films, best American films, because I feel like it you can't really take it out of that context, and I think it's stronger within the context.
That's a good point, actually.
It's
agree with that.
So meta, it's so about what it's about, that I feel like it doesn't exist in the realm of what you would call like reality in terms of real feeling or pathos, or you know, it's not an international art house. It's not a Rossellini movie. I feel like when you compare it, you know, especially to the other films that are on the Sight and Sound list, it seems
it's funny because it really did remind me of Gertrude. with the mirrors especially.
Okay,
that's a good point. And I mean, It can have flavors of international films and still mostly be Hollywood, because I agree. It's very much an American movie about American movies, even though theoretically it's about the theater. To divorce it from that context is actually to lose a great deal of its power.
Yeah, I think you need to know a lot about where it's coming from and who the players are and the fact that it is multi-layered in order to really appreciate it. I think without those contexts, it does lose something. But I have no compunction about putting it on a FlixWise favorites. It's good, and I think it's a very rich text, especially when we're talking about the career of Bette Davis, which is what we're talking about.
Anne, how about you?
I'm all for it.
Okay. Cool.
I'm all about you.
Okay, good. Same. Yeah, I guess allow me just a full-throated endorsement of this movie. Like, just, I get so much pleasure watching this film, and it's not an intellectual pleasure. It's just watching Bette Davis, first of all. Always fun. And here, she's not doing, like, the grotesque, like, even when she's younger, she's, like, always punishing herself and, like, people, you know, think of now Voyager, where she's the sad, dowdy aunt, or Dark Victory, where she dies at the end. Spoiler. or, you know, Jezebel, at the end, punished through the whole movie. Mm. That's what the movie is about. It's just her being publicly
shamed.
The movie's
called Jezebel. That's a pretty good indication of what's going to happen.
Name right in the title.
So in this one, she's allowed to be her gloriously bitchy self. And she's celebrated for it. It's fantastic.
She's within a milieu of glorious bitches.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
She's not the only one in the kennel.
No.
to borrow a line from her rival.
That's right.
Joan Crawford.
Yes. We'll get to that. But yeah, so, and I get just to reiterate, like, Anne Baxter's so great in this and lends it so much. I think that's where a lot of the pathos does come from, because I do feel I understand her struggle, especially given the gay subtext. Like, watching it this time, I was like, oh my god.
She gay.
Yeah.
She's super gay.
Yeah. Oh, and I totally understand, like, her like, I read it as sort of not so much that she is conniving, but she's also, like, just this inability to kind of just come out and say what she wants, right? Because maybe that it wouldn't be allowed. And so looking at it from that perspective, it lent a whole new just level of, I don't know, just sadness and, and great bedroom eyes, Anne Baxter. Love her voice. And I love that turn she makes when it all is revealed that she is, in fact, evil.
It's a good turn.
Yeah.
I know we've been harping on the queerness of the movie a lot. I hesitate to read too much humanity into Eve just because I don't think it exists in the script.
Mm.
It's especially when you're trying to find queer characters in classic Hollywood, it's easy to project things that you want to see onto them. Mm-hmm. But, like, this is a movie from 1950 written by a straight guy at a time when, like, female sexuality in general wasn't talked about, much less any kind of quote-unquote aberrant sexuality. So, like, I think for the most part she's a predatory lesbian. She does it amazingly well because it's Anne Baxter at, like, peak performance level. But I'm just a little bit concerned about, like, trying to read her as any kind of sympathetic character, because I don't think the movie thinks she is.
Maybe. I don't know. I think maybe Anne Baxter thinks she is, though.
I mean, if that exists in it, that's awesome, but that's not what the rest of the movie is telling her that she is.
Maybe. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, maybe it's not text, but it's kind of my armchair psychologist.
I mean, I love Mrs. Danvers to death, but ain't nobody sitting there going, you know, I really think Mrs. Danvers is misunderstood in this movie. Like, she burns down the house out of love.
Sure, But, well, that may not have been the director's intention. I don't know. I appreciate it. I think that there is depth to that character. I don't think she was meant to be just an evil villainess. I think she is a real character. And part of the reason why it plays is because Anne Baxter is so good. And I also don't think she gets enough credit, because she gets a lot of crap because she positioned herself as a lead actress instead of the supporting actress, denying mm-hmm. both her and Bette Davis Oscars. But
You could argue Gloria Swanson helped that too.
That
was the year of Sunset Boulevard too.
Right. I've heard people say, like, if there was a real life All About Eve story, no, that wasn't what was happening. They were actually good friends. But I think it should be on the Flixoid's favorites list.
20 minutes later.
Yeah. And that's the way we frame it. Flixwise, that is. Listeners, do you dislike All About Eve? Come let us know on our website, flixwise.com. Don't worry, we'll see to it that you have your meds adjusted. And you can also leave us a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/flixwise. And if you are looking for someone to revel with you in the glory that is Bette Davis, you should probably come find me on Twitter. The handle is at flixwise. But wait, you haven't rated us on iTunes yet? Kind of an Eve move, don't you think? Here we are giving you these beautiful podcasts, and you can't even bother to leave us some stars. Well, fortunately, you can do right by us by going to iTunes or Google Play or your pod player of choice and subscribe and leave us a nice comment on our next show. Our All About Bette marathon continues as Anne tells us why she thinks William Wyler's 1941 adaptation of Lillian Hellman's play The Little Foxes is one of the greatest cinematic achievements of all time.
Those are strong words.
Or maybe...
We all signed up for this.
Yeah.
The internet.
It's a high bar, you know. Yeah. It's the best ever.
You can't have lukewarm takes. Yeah.
Nope.
All takes must be hot.
Until then, Kristen, thank you so much for presenting All About E for us.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Yeah. Right, Anne, amazing as always.
Why, thank you.
All right, let the Liebstrom play on.